here. Hello and welcome to Talk Gnosis. My name is Deacon Jonathan Stewart, and today we have a very fascinating show. I don't want people to think that we've gone to the dark side, we've been abducted and replaced with alien clones, or that we're trying to get the easy clicks with sensationalism, because today's topic is the UFOs and the UFO phenomenon. I think people are going to be pleasantly surprised how much of what we're going to talk about today fits in with a lot of the themes and subjects that have popped up often on Talk Gnosis. But to talk about this is Dr. David Halperin, the author of Intimate Alien. Hello, Dr. Halperin.
Hello, Deacon John.
It's a real pleasure to have you here. And of course, could you tell us just a little bit about your background, your academic background, and your book, Intimate Alien?
Yes. Let's start out with the 1960s when I was a teenage ufologist, completely convinced that UFOs were real and that it was my life's mission to solve their mystery. And then I grew up to become a professor of religious studies. I taught for many years at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. My area of expertise was Judaica. My field of special interest was religious traditions of heavenly ascents and otherworldly journeys, which I think even at the time I recognized as my old ufology in a more academically respectable guise. I've long since stopped believing in UFOs, but they've never ceased to cast their spell on me. And what I try to do in Intimate Alien, the hidden story of the UFO, is to talk about what that spell is, how it captivated and still captivates me, and how it captivates millions of others.
It's a book that I really love and have pushed upon a lot of people. It's also extremely and beautifully written as well, so I would like to reassure people, sometimes perhaps, and I'm not trying to cast aspersions, people hear religious studies professor and they're like, well, I don't know, but is this the right book for me? Is this something I can grab off the shelf? But it's so accessible and so beautifully written. But in the book, you write about how UFOs are a myth. So when a lot of people hear that, I think what they're interpreting you saying is like UFOs are fake. It's a fake phenomenon. It's an urban legend. But I don't think that's what you mean. So can you talk about how UFOs are myths and what you mean by this term myth?
Yeah, I mean, people use myth to mean bunk or nonsense. And to me, a myth is almost the polar opposite of nonsense. It's the profoundest sense. I think of it as a collective dream of our culture and perhaps of our entire species. It comes bearing things that we may not want to see, may not want to hear, but which we need to see and to hear. It carries its own guarantee of authenticity. 1,000 pieces of evidence can be advanced that UFOs are real. They are all irrelevant, and if they are debunked, it doesn't affect the basic conviction that the myth carries. That is why they are debunked over and over. They have been debunked now for better than 7 decades. And the UFOs, as we see, from just skimming the media over the past couple of months are still very much with us.
Yeah, so I guess I'm wondering, with UFOs having this deeper meaning, but perhaps not being as real or physical as some people like or imagine them to be. But I guess I was curious, if I had been hitchhiking down that dark highway, would I have seen what Barney and Betty Hill had seen when they had their UFO encounter?
Okay, so let's transport ourselves back to September 1961. Betty and Barney Hill, a mixed race couple. Barney is black and Betty is white, which I think is absolutely crucial to the story, are pulling an all-nighter, driving through the White Mountains of New Hampshire, trying to get home from a vacation trip to Canada. Now, John, let's imagine ourselves first as flies on their window, and then let's imagine ourselves as you and me, right? As flies on our window, I think we would see a peculiar light, not particularly outstanding in its appearance, but its behavior is rather weird, and we would see two people getting completely hysterical over it. But now suppose we were there as human hitchhikers on the back seat of their car. I don't think the incident would have happened at all. Because one of my convictions is that the witnesses are an essential part of a UFO sighting. And I think it was essential to this sighting that Betty and Barney be together, just themselves.
So on the show, we've talked about Jung a few times in a few different contexts, but I was wondering if you could tell us about your inspiration from Jung's views on UFOs, and maybe about how some of Jung's ideas and related to Jung's ideas about the unconscious and the collective unconscious can help us to understand this UFO phenomenon.
I first met Jung at age 12 when his book was the last book he published before his death, his 1958 book, Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Skies, was one of the three books on flying saucers in our local library at Levittown, Pennsylvania. I read the book and, of course, couldn't make head or tail out of it. How is it possible for a 12-year-old to understand Jung? I hadn't a clue as to the fundamental assumptions on which it rests, that our conscious awareness is like a small boat floating on the vast sea of the unconscious, which we share with others in our culture, and perhaps with every human being. It was only in the years that followed, particularly after I met Jacques Vallée in 1970, and we can talk a bit more about Jacques Vallée, that I realized I needed to give Jung another try. And I found that his ideas helped me understand all sorts of things about UFOs, which I had found baffling. For example, why are they disc-shaped? In terms of aerodynamics, a disc-shaped flying machine doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But if you take Jung's premise that what we call UFOs are mandalas, and what an archetype of totality, as he called them, projected from inside us, and that the function of the mandala is the unification of opposites, then I can begin to understand why in a torn world we would see such things in the sky.
Yeah.
Now, I don't like to call myself a Jungian. I'll call myself a quasi-Jungian, which is to say, I will take up Jung's ideas where they work, disregard them where they don't. But again and again, in dealing with UFOs, I found Jung's ideas, I won't use the word essential, that would go a little bit too far, but that they made better sense of what was otherwise baffling than anything else. So in that way, I made use of them.
Yeah. And to be fair to 12-year-old David Halperin, I'm almost 40, and sometimes I have trouble understanding Jung. So I could only imagine trying as a preteen.
And 73-year-old David Halperin sometimes has trouble too. But just imagine how at age 12 I was utterly at sea. One thing I understood, that Jung did not, as I thought all psychologists did, reduce everything to sex. That this was part of his running quarrel with his long dead papa Freud, whom I also read as an adult, and whom I also found, just as I found Jung, very enlightening. And in the book I've used his insights as well.
I've recently been coming back a lot to Freud and looking to work him into this show as well. But, oh, actually, our co-host Jason was able to make it, so I'm just going to bring him into the stream. Hello, Jason.
Hello. Sorry I was late. A little bit of a misunderstanding schedule-wise, but I'm here.
so glad that you're able to join us.
I suppose maybe you could say this is a lost time situation.
Yes, that's it precisely.
So we're reenacting the myth.
Yes.
Well, and isn't that what happens all the time? you guys keep going, and I'll hop in when it seems reasonable.
Perfect. Well, we just finished talking about our good friend Jung, and I was about to ask David about some of his biography and about what he writes in his book, which he writes quite, again, beautifully about. So David, can you tell us about how you became interested in UFOs, and can you tell us about what the UFO myth has taught you about yourself and your own psyche?
Okay. I'm going to start with about 15 years after my discovery of UFOs, when I came upon, it was in 1975, I came upon a book that, and by that time I wasn't doing anything serious with UFOs, I came across a book that was published in 1972, giving the texts of papers that had been delivered another 3 years earlier in 1969 at a symposium of the American Association of the Advancement of Science. The book was called UFOs, A Scientific Debate. And there was a paper by two psychiatrists, Lester Grinspoon and Alan Persky, that gave a number of Freudian interpretations of UFOs, which at the time I found rather unconvincing. But then at the very end, they gave us kind of a throwaway line that it seemed to them that belief in the extraterrestrial hypothesis is connected with a denial of the finite nature of life. And conversely, those with a need to deny that there is any anxiety at all around issues of death and immortality may be led to attack the hypothesis with considerable passion. And all the lights went on in my head. Bingo, this was it. Because I grew up with death. My mother, for most of my life, from She had a heart attack when I was 3. And for the next 13 years, she was slowly dying of a heart condition, which could not be spoken of in our household. I was an only child because my birth had probably aggravated her condition, and she could have no more children. So this was the reality that I was coping with. And out of the midst of that reality, I discovered UFOs. I discovered it through the second book in our public library, which was Grave Barker's They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers. This is the book that begot the myth of the three men in black, which we may want to talk about more. Those mysterious beings, perhaps government agents, perhaps extraterrestrials, perhaps something even more fantastic, who visit you when you solve the dreadful secret of the UFOs, and they terrorize you into silence. Now, I read this book and was at once convinced. And looking back, I understand why I was so convinced, that I knew the men in black personally. I knew that there was a terrible secret in our household that could not be spoken of. So, and I knew that Gray Barker, in the language of myth, was telling a truth that no one would admit to me. From then on, the UFOs became a mirror. I think of the mirrored shield that Perseus used in facing Medusa, that I had to face the Medusa of death. And it was being able to see death in the mirror of the UFO that made it possible for me to do that. That was why I simultaneously believed that UFOs were hostile. Death is about as hostile as anything you want to imagine. And at the same time, I couldn't stand the idea that anyone could prove to me that they didn't exist, because if I gave up the UFOs, my mirror would be shattered and I would have to look into the Gorgon's face directly. And I do not know what kind of stone I would have been turned into. So this was what UFOs meant to me personally. Reflecting on them has taught me that the issue of mortality has been something vital to me all my life. I think it's vital to all of us, but perhaps I was a bit more sensitive to it than most. And therefore, I became and remained a ufologist, and others did not.
Yeah. A lot of people, we talked about myth and what you mean by myth, and maybe perhaps a deeper meaning of the word myth than how we use it in day-to-day language. But at the same time, people get antsy, again, in polite company, and the normal usage of the word myth when we connect it to religion. They don't want to, particularly if they're people of faith, have myth and religion be together. But you're a scholar of religion. Are UFOs a religious experience?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, UFO lore. Okay. A UFO encounter, insofar as it's not something that can be very simply explained by I don't know, a Goodyear blimp reflecting the sunset or something like that. But a UFO encounter of a more genuine kind is a bona fide religious experience. And UFO lore is a religious myth that makes it possible for those who've not been blessed by the direct experience of this numinous entity, the UFO, to share in the awareness of it. I would not have the slightest hesitation referring to religious myth, to biblical myth, and some of the Bible stories. I'm thinking particularly of the story of the Garden of Eden in Genesis, to me are true, not in spite of being myths, but precisely because they are myths.
You know, it strikes me, and when I was putting together the questions for this sheet, that somehow I left out. On the show, we talk a lot about Gnostic ascent. You know, the Gnostics were inspired by Merkaba mysticism and other cultural strands around them, and ascent was very important for them. And you are actually kind of an expert on ascent traditions, right, and mystical ascent. Do you see any connections specifically between these ascent traditions and the UFO experience?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, I wrote my dissertation on the rabbinic testimonies about the Merkava mysticism, the ascents, which the people who were involved with them called them descents. Mm-hmm. That is an intriguing paradox, which the UFOs help us understand. So I wrote my dissertation on that, and that is what occupied me certainly during my earlier years as a researcher of religion, and I knew it was UFOs.
Yeah. Actually, could you elaborate on the, because there's this intriguing phrase that pops up in the Nag Hammadi library a couple times, which is, to ascend, you must first descend. You just mentioned the paradox of they called it descent. So can you tell us a little bit about that paradox and how UFOs help resolve the paradox? How they're the mandala mm-hmm. that resolved that paradox?
Yes, I can draw upon no less than Gershom Scholem, no less a figure mm-hmm. than Gershom Scholem. He died in 1982, but I would say he remains the greatest scholar of Jewish mysticism of our time. That he called it a yet unexplained turn of phrase, that the Merkava mystics spoke of their journey to the Merkava, and I don't think we've defined that word. It's the word that comes to be used in rabbinic Judaism for the totality of what Ezekiel experienced. That the people who want to replicate Ezekiel's experience speak of themselves as descending to the Merkava. One of the texts, the Merkava text begins, what are the hymns and songs by which the one who wants to descend to the Merkava descends to it, and the one who wants to ascend from it can ascend from it, that is, come back to earthly life. Now, in the hypnotic trances of the UFO abductees, which is a UFO abduction is a phenomenon that begins with Betty and Barney Hill in the early 1960s, but it only blossoms really in the late 80s and in the 90s. And in the hypnotic trances that the abductees undergo, again and again, they go down, and they don't understand why they should be going down, but they're going down. I mean, there's an account of a hypnotic session conducted by Bud Hopkins, who was probably the major advocate of UFO abductions, the late Bud Hopkins. He died in 2011. And the person he's hypnotizing says, we're going down. And he says, wait a minute, you shouldn't be going down. You should be going up. No, no, we're going down. So I think what we are dealing with is an experience that people had in antiquity. People had it in the 90s with some frequency. I think to some extent also today, although as a cultural phenomenon, it's past its day. And I think many ufologists even are kind of embarrassed by it. But that this is something that has remained stable in its basic outline and yet has taken on new shapes following the experience of Betty and Barney Hill. I've gotten a bit convoluted here. Has it come across clearly?
It has. Thank you very much. And Jason, yes, please.
Yeah, no, I want to dive into a bunch of stuff here because I think Jonathan's question about like linking the notion of Gnostic ascent into the UFO myths of ascent, like part of what I've been excited about for this conversation has been like teasing out the like how to make this Gnostic, if that makes sense. And so like one of the things I find fascinating is like Gnostic myth has sort of a protective layer keeping us from a more divine place. And that protective layer is a lot of rules, is a lot of people or things controlling us. And then there's something past that with like knowledge we can't even comprehend. And I find so much of this like, what I find about the UFOlogy is that it's so rich and flexible, if that makes sense, that it's like, you know, like some of it is like you've got governmental forces, you know, like as you were saying before, they're like Men in Black agents that are essentially the archonic forces keeping us back. They won't let us know the secrets. They're holding everything back. And sometimes it's the aliens themselves who are like taking us away and doing things to us that are uncomfortable and that we don't like. But in other cases, it is like there's this sense of like that like they're here to take us away or help us in some way. And I guess maybe what I'm really riffing on is how open the myth is to interpretation, because there has never been like a UFO text. You know what I mean? There's never been a Nag Hammadi of Roswell, you know?
That is interesting. I must tell you, I hadn't thought of the parallel between the Archons and the Men in Black. They don't dress in black, do they? The Archons?
They can dress however they want. But I don't know, actually, Jonathan might have more archonic knowledge than I do.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think that that's a specific thing about them in the mythology. But I think the comparison is pretty accurate, Jason. I think it is perhaps looking at the same myth with some different mythological figures and the worldviews, that there might be some similarities and perhaps getting at the same mythical truth. So, yeah, exactly.
The real thing I'd love to go on if this feels like a valid direction is about that sort of like I say, that flexibility or liquidity of the UFOlogy myth in general, because like I say, because there isn't a text, you know, there isn't a tradition that's holding the UFO myth in a particular place. Like how much of it is very much like born out of the times in which it came, and like now that I think it's kind of having a bit of a resurgence, like it's not going to look the same as it did in the like say 60s to 80s, you know? So if I can tease that out at all as it relates to this like interplay of myth and Gnosticism we've been discussing so far.
No, it's true. There is no canonical text. Now there are certain patterns that tend to be fixed, and I would almost say canonical, and that is in the tradition of alien abduction, where the events take place on a double plane. That since an essential part of the alien abduction tradition is that the experiencers forget their experience or forget crucial parts of it, and then are led back to remember it by a therapist slash hypnotist, that the story takes place rather like a shamanistic seance, to which it's been compared, on two planes. One, I, the experiencer, am lying on a couch in the therapist's office, and I'm in trance, and the old-fashioned tape recorder, the wheels are spinning while I tell my story, and then the other plane on which it's happening is on the spaceship. And I've been struck that if you compare the excellent 1975 TV movie, The UFO Incident, with the, I think, kind of crummy 2010 thriller, The Fourth Kind, that pattern remains intact despite the 35 years gap between them. So there is a certain canonicity in that, but I think not of text.
Yeah. And I think too, it's the comment on what Jason was saying is it's pretty neat how the UFO myth becomes a container or a Russian nesting doll of all these other sort of mythological themes and patterns and even myths that seem to be very ancient and old, right? We can sort of find all these variations, which actually maybe we'll get into now as we're sort of talking about the Men in Black and connecting them to perhaps some more older legends besides the Archons. But can you tell us what the Men in Black have to do with a 17th century Kabbalist?
Because they come visit him. I mean, the Kabbalist is Abraham Cardozo, who was not merely a Kabbalist, but a follower of the false messiah, Shabbatai Tzvi, who set the Jewish world aflame in 1665 with his claim of being messiah, and then shocked that world by converting to Islam. Cardozo was one of his followers, and perhaps the most brilliant and independent of his followers. And he describes an extraordinary experience that he had in July of 1683, when he went into his garden with some of his friends and family and looked up at the moon. And he saw four shapes on the moon, one of them female, the other three male. And he never identified the female. I think I can identify her, and we can go back to that. But the males he identified as blessed ghosts. Shabbatai Tzvi himself, a Kabbalist, a prophet, all of whom were dead. And then the three men come to visit Cardozo in his bedroom. And the story becomes very ugly. It turns out they are not blessed ghosts, as Cardozo thought them, but demons who have come to lure him into heresy. By most Jewish standards, by the way, Cardozo was heretical enough, but he had his own notion of heresy, and they were trying to tempt him into believing heresies. And when he called upon God to send fire to burn them, they called on their demon god to send fire to burn Cardozo, and he fell sick with a fever, a burning fever, and took to his bed, and dressed in black, they stood by his bedside watching him. Eventually, he did manage to get rid of them. It seems to me we are dealing here with a phenomenon that can be compared to the myth that erupted in an American context in 1953, when UFO researcher Albert Bender was visited by three men in black who terrified him into silence. Now, I think here we've got a really nice example of an intersection between historical fact and primordial myth, because I think that Bender was really visited by three men. They weren't dressed in black. He didn't say that. He said something slightly different, which was later turned into Men in Black. And I think they were FBI agents, and I think they visited him for reasons that had nothing to do with flying saucers that they had managed to convince themselves that Bender's International Flying Saucer Bureau was a communist front organization that needed to be shut down. Okay, and that is the historical germ of our modern myth of the Men in Black. But Cardozo's experience suggests that it goes back much farther.
Yeah. So we try to have fun on the show, keep it light, be accessible. You know, we goof around and kid around, but we kind of started the show to be at the same time, the sort of serious and academic esoteric podcast. So basically, until right now, I've never had an excuse to talk about the Shaver mystery, which I deeply love. And I actually, you know, I have read some of some collections of Shaver's work. I have the books that collect his rock paintings. So here's my opportunity, finally. Can you tell us a bit about the so-called Shaver mystery and really Shaver's myths with an S? What his myths tell us about him as well as the world and the society that he lived in?
Well, first of all, let's give a chronological statement that the UFOs began as a cultural phenomenon in the summer of 1947. The Shaver mystery goes back a few years before that, to the years of the war. And it can be read as a kind of dress rehearsal for the grand drama of the UFO. Its name is kind of odd and not altogether accurate, because it was not only Shaver's, it was a joint creation of Shaver and a man named Raymond Palmer. One of the things the patterns that I kept stumbling across in researching my book is that the myths tend to be creations, not of a single person, but of synergistic pair, often of opposites. Betty and Barney Hill is one example, Richard Shaver and Raymond Palmer is another example. And we also have to ask why it's called a mystery. It feels more like a myth than a mystery. And I think I'm going to want to come back to that. That what it is the myth that underneath the surface of the earth, there live a race of perverted, sadistic dwarves. They are called Deros. They are the descendants of the elder races who came from outer space to populate this planet eons ago and abandoned it because they were being poisoned by the sun's rays. The Deros are their descendants, but have become horribly warped by the influence of the rays. We are their descendants too. And the Deros live beneath our feet, unbeknownst to us, and they prey upon us. They kidnap us, use us, take us to their dungeons, and perform sadistic, tortures for the sake of torture. I won't even use the word experiments. Shaver became aware of this through his own experiences. There are a number of versions of how he did it. He sent an account of this to the magazine that Palmer edited amazing stories in the guise of a philological argument. I think if I get into that, it would take us a bit too far astray. And over the next few years, he published stories in Amazing Stories that were nominally fiction. You had to guess how much truth there was involving the caverns and the struggles between the evil Deeros. And there was also a minority of decent cavern dwellers called Tiros. Now, what are we to say about this story? On the one level, it's a mirror of its times. That World War II was a time of hells on earth. And when the Shaver mysteries, the Shaver stories started really circulating, we were beginning to know about Hitler's Darrow-esque death camps and the horrors that were demonstrated at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But on another level, it's a myth of the evil that exists within us, that we are all prone to. And that with Hiroshima and Nagasaki erupted onto the world. And if you will excuse me, let me read, I've quoted it in my book. Let me read from something that Arnold published in August, or that he wrote in August of 1945. He was working on an edition of some of Shaver's stories when he heard the news of Hiroshima. And he wrote, "War has come to a horrible pass. It has come to its ultimate pass. With atomic energy at his disposal, the next war means the certain end of civilization. No longer is the destructive power of Shaver's imaginary or not underground science the secret of the underground." Notice he says imaginary or not. He knows perfectly well that Shaver, who spent much of his life in mental hospitals, was coming up with this stuff from inside himself. But it's still no longer the secret of the underground. It is on the surface now. Did it perhaps come from the underground? What strange guidance might our scientists have had? And I think there is the crux of what the Shaver mystery is about. The hidden horror that can erupt into the world. And it's called mystery. I think it was Palmer who gave it that name. Because to Palmer, mystery was, it's not a riddle to be solved, but a state of soul, of mind, in which you are open to the wonders that lie beyond your awareness. And that was how Palmer promoted and why he believed in the Shaver mystery, even though he knew it was imaginary.
Thank you so much. I'm glad I finally got to work that into the show. So I really appreciate that. And of course, to examine what it really means. So UFO encounters they seem to mess up a lot of people's lives. But can the experience also call us towards psychological wholeness? Do they always mess up people's lives?
I don't know. I'll take Betty and Barney. It's a difficult question. I'll take Betty and Barney in as an example. That, as you know, one of my arguments in the book is that the abduction tradition, as it was shaped by the hypnotic regression of the Hills, goes back to an ancestral awareness of Barney's ancestors' abduction into slavery. That, like the Hills themselves, Barney's ancestors were abducted in the middle of the night, taken aboard an alien ship, and subjected to strange and humiliating examinations. It seems to have had a therapeutic effect on Barney to have retrieved those memories, however disguised they were. He speaks of feeling like heavy chains are falling from off his shoulders. And I think the myth that he and Betty created together made it possible, reduce the barriers between them as the offspring of slaves and the offspring of the people who had committed the atrocity of slavery. But then Barney died. He died at age, I think, 46 of a cerebral hemorrhage, 5 years almost to the day after the memories first began to emerge. So would he have been better off if he had not recovered those memories? I don't know.
Well, unfortunately, we aren't. I know you have to go in about 10 minutes and we have to finish up. But before we do, Jason, do you have questions, follow-up thoughts, rabbit holes you want to go down?
I'm actually still kind of going back to that notion of like the connection to various levels of myth, and I think when the abduction discussion was coming up and the consistency of that, one of the things, and I know I'm not the first one to relate this, but one of the things that also struck me was the connection with stories of fairy abduction, like people being taken into the world of fairies. It's in the circle, you know. There's lost time, you know. And it's an experience that's only being related after the fact, usually in a revelation that wasn't immediately afterwards. They didn't just they come out of the circle going like, oh hey, everything's normal, right? You know. So I guess that's not even really a question. I just found myself responding to the idea now, like on one hand, yes, isn't it interesting that they're connected, but also like going into the mythological, psychological value or the thing that is being like kind of expressed or worked through in that mode of abduction. Like, I guess, I don't know if I specifically have a question, like, is it a way of like a sort of psychologically reacting to a world that seems to kind of be against you, is to like come up with a situation that, or to experience a situation that really like cements and personifies this sense of separation from the world? I don't know. I'm kind of just teasing off in directions here.
Yeah, here we'd go into more speculation, I think, than I'm comfortable with. But I certainly agree with you about the parallels with fairy lore and with other traditional lore. This was, I would have to say, of the three things, books are not quite the word, that shaped my approach. The first was Jung, his Flying Saucer book of 58. The third was the comments by those two psychiatrists I told you about, which flagged the relation between the UFO and death, which I think is its most central meaning. That's the intimate alien of my title. Death is the most alien thing we can conceive, and also the most intimate. And the middle one, the second one, was Jacques Vallée's Passport to Magonia, which was published in 1969, in which he flagged the resemblances between the UFO stories and these traditional stories. He did not conclude, as he might conceivably have done, that UFOs don't exist any more than fairies do. He thought that all of them were testimonies to a world that intersects ours, but is not quite the same as ours. And to that world, he gave the name Magonia. I don't accept that explanation, but the phenomenon that he's flagged, I think, is very important. And it calls attention to what I see as the two-sidedness of the UFO myth. On the one hand, it's a myth that's born within historical time and recent historical time. The abduction tradition is born with the hypnotic regression of Betty and Barney Hill in 1964. The Men in Black tradition is born with the FBI's visit to Albert Bender in 1953. And yet behind the history of these myths, there's also a prehistory that goes back, in the case of abductions, that to encompass Merkava mysticism. In the case of the Men in Black, that encompasses Cardozo, that encompasses the Man in Black, who keeps cropping up in 17th century witch trials. And I think that the interaction between the history and prehistory is part of what gives UFOs their magic.
Yeah. Dr. Halpern, but before we let you go, because we'll probably get some letters, but you left one thing hanging, which was the possible identity of the woman on the moon that Cardozo saw. So you mentioned the three men in black.
Yeah. Did I leave that hanging? Well, I have to tell you that Cardozo was brought up a Catholic. And he is from a family of Maranos, that is, Jews who converted to Catholicism so they wouldn't have to leave Spain in 1492, and who kept their Judaism as a secret. But he was exposed as a child to the piety of 17th century Spain, in which the Virgin Mary as Immaculate Conception was depicted again and again standing on the moon. Mm-hmm. And she, I think, erupts out of his unconscious that July evening in 1683.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Halpern, I've been putting your website up on the screen for everybody, but for those listening, it's davinhalpern.net if they want to know more about you, buy your book, read your blog. That's right?
That's right.
And I should say books, because of course we do have an audience interested in lots of things. I know that we do have definitely have viewers and listeners who are interested in the Fracas and Chavez Zevi. So, and I'm hoping that you will come back when you finish your translation or release your translation of I Came This Day to the Spring, because Dr. Halpern, this is a Kabbalistic text, Jason. And I want us to talk about it without you knowing anything about it, because I just want to watch your head explode, because it's quite the text, people.
I can't wait. That sounds amazing. That sounds like a part two of this conversation. I also have to point out before we go that just as we were, like, I think Dr. Halpern, when you were discussing death being the ultimate alien, that it just, just as we're signing off, that, like, it turns out that Star Trek VI is called The Undiscovered Country, which is referencing Hamlet, who is referencing death, and it's a movie full of aliens and a ship captain who's trying to face his own mortality. So I think probably not as deep or as involved as what we've been talking about so far, but maybe a fun little, like, coincidence to toss into the end here. Oh, and the Enterprise has a saucer.
Any explanation of why?
The Star Trek lore nerd in me is going to need a minute here. Actually, I think honestly, you know, maybe this does all link together. I think because the original show was made in the 60s. And I think the design of the Enterprise was in some way inspired by the flying saucer mythology of the times. And so, like, they gave it a saucer section and then, like, a lower area where the engine would be and then, like, little sort of wings that would come out that would power the ship. But so maybe it does all kind of come around. Like, this science fiction TV show is inspired by UFOlogy and then itself has to, in some of its stories, has to really engage with the most alien part of the world that we know.
Intriguing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if that's what the UFO myth is about, then when people make fictional stuff based on it, that mythology is going to be worked in there, right? And
exactly.
And of course, yeah. You know, people do. There are people out there that treat Star Trek in basically have a religious relationship with it. So the parallels just keep going. Okay, well, we should sign off. Thanks again, David. It's been amazing. So
thank you so much for having me.
It's really been our pleasure. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye, everybody. Bye.